Hello, and welcome to another conversation with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi there, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
Rupert, I wanted to talk about the place of humanity in nature. And this is quite a pressing issue for me at the moment because I'm working on William Blake. And Blake is very clear that human beings do have a particular and distinctive place in nature. And this seems to conflict with a lot of thought, both sort of general, but particularly ecological, which is quite inclined to see humanity as a problem, if not the problem in nature, as if nature might be better off without us, as opposed to Blake's view, which is very clear, actually, that we add something to the natural world, as well as being part of the natural world, of course, that would be a loss to the natural world without that. So I wanted to tease sort of these things apart. I mean, maybe a starting point is to ask you, you know, how do you see our place in nature? Are we a problem, or is there something more subtle that your work illuminates?
I don't know if my work illuminates it, but it clearly it depends what point of view you look at. If you look at ecological destruction, destruction of species, diversity, etc., we're definitely a problem. You know, the climate change and so on. Climate change has happened many times in the past without human beings, so it's not as if we're uniquely responsible for climate change. I mean, after all, there was a whole series of ice ages, which were about as dramatic a climate change as you can get. Had nothing to do with humanity. So clearly we're a kind of problem at the moment, but also we bring something to the world, maybe the whole universe, which wasn't there before. And clearly that's to do with both our consciousness, our inventiveness, our creativity, and our technologies. And without human beings, the whole of the other realms of life on Earth, including, well, I mean, plants, animals, fungi, bacteria, are classified by us, studied by us. The rocks and the history of the Earth are illuminated by geology and evolutionary science. Astronomy and cosmology reveal to us the size and nature of heavenly bodies like stars and planets and galaxies. No one knew there were galaxies until about 100 years ago. I mean, this is all quite new discoveries. Then, of course, all these technological advances that enable rapid communication, you know, heavy lifting, transport and railways. I mean, all there's so many microscopes. All of these things illuminate the realm of nature in and bring it into consciousness. And it's only through humans that that can happen. So there's clearly something very special about what we are doing, in, as well as these terrible destructive effects we have on the world, bringing into consciousness something about the nature of the universe. And we just don't know, when we look out at the sky at night, whether there are beings on other planets who have telescopes and Hubble Space Telescopes and James Webb telescopes and things, who are studying the whole cosmos, or whether it's only human minds that have penetrated beyond their local solar system to the vastness of the cosmos. It may be only human minds may have done this, we don't know. So it seems to me that that's one of the great aspects of humanity. The other one, I suppose, is the one that all religions emphasize, namely the capacity of humans to connect with the divine mind or the ultimate consciousness, and therefore have a direct connection or insight into ultimate reality, a direct link. And in Christianity, of course, this comes out in the idea of Jesus as the Son of God, as a human being filled with the divine nature, human and divine at the same time. And this then feeds into a whole series of movements through Christian history of the idea of the divinization of humanity. I mean, even in a secular form, in the early Soviet Union, they called themselves the God Makers because they saw themselves as transforming humanity, where humans had actually become God in the ideas of some secular humanists. But this is all to do with this transformational complexity of that humans' consciousness brings to the universe. So it seems to me that that presumably is the main thing that we'd have to cling on to if we want to think of ourselves as very special and maybe inevitable, or certainly a major part of the cosmic evolutionary process.
Yeah, those ideas maybe connect in with notions of emergence. In a way, perhaps you're alluding there to the idea that the cosmic story can be told as one, not just of gradual development, but the emergence of radically new forms. So from an undifferentiated, hyper-dense ball of energy just after the Big Bang, there's a bit of cooling, and with that comes a phase transition from which subatomic particles and then atoms emerge, and then you get molecules, and then you gradually get the coalescence of molecules and into stars and so on, and you get new processes being formed and planets, all sorts of things start to emerge along this pathway with these phase transitions that just weren't conceivable before. And of course, eventually you get life, so animate as well as inanimate things, and then consciousness, and then even self-consciousness, you know, as we have. And so in some way, we are maybe not just part of this process, and maybe not even just, so far as we know, the most complex form that this process has so far given rise to. But when you integrate or think about this notion of the phase transitions, the point about this is, how does real novelty enter the cosmos through processes of emergence? Are sort of bottom-up processes enough to account for this? And my understanding is that there's quite a debate about this, partly in evolutionary circles, actually, but also when you consider the philosophical implications of this kind of physics. And what I gather, and you can read it in cosmologists such as Paul Davies, is that there's a proposal that, as Paul Davies puts it, there's a kind of life principle, which is a dynamic within the cosmos that tends towards this complexity, and so in a way tends towards us. You can add in a little bit of panpsychism. I've recently been reading the new book by Philip Goff, the philosopher who's a great advocate of panpsychism. And if you add that element in, then there's some sense in which the cosmos, its own intelligence, its own mind, inclines things to go in a certain way that leads to us, and even gather up our suffering, what happens to us, in order that a different future might be possible. But maybe you can even add a sort of third level to that, which is that if there are top-down processes as well as bottom-up processes, or you might even say a kind of pull from the future as much as a tendency from the past, then we, in terms of the complexity of things, might be in the sort of vanguard of that by the exercise of our consciousness with this particular element of self-consciousness. And so I don't know whether this is quite how any scientists would put it, but are in the leading edge of these developments. And so are necessary, not just as that from that which has emerged, but that which might emerge too. This is all premised on the idea that, on, you know, the assumption that we're the only self-conscious creatures in the cosmos, which of course is very moot, to many seems very unlikely. But nonetheless, that would only say that this is happening with parallel creatures such as us elsewhere feeding into the whole story. But anyway, this sort of notion of strong emergence, and that there's a kind of backward or a downward causation as much as things coming from the past, notwithstanding, as you're saying, the destruction and the problem that we are in that way, does situate us in a different way, even from a, you know, it's more speculative science, but from a scientific point of view. Have you heard these kind of stories being told?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, the idea of creativity, you know, from the bottom up emergence or from the top down, is a very old dichotomy in thinking about creation. I mean, the scientific view in the light of Darwin and Darwinism has tended to have a bottom-up view. You know, we start with tiny single protocells and they get more complex and so on, then brains emerge and consciousness appears and so on. That's a kind of bottom-up view. But the top-down view is also a very traditional one. And in the past, the Greeks thought that the human inspiration was caused by the muses, that they inspired music and other arts, the idea of inspiration, of breathing in from a higher level is there. And it's, I mean, you get the, as Father Bede used to point out to me when I lived in his ashram in India, you get this split in Christology. The first three Gospels have a man, Jesus, who becomes God. And the fourth Gospel, St. John's Gospel, has God who becomes man. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. So it was a descending Christology. Christ descends from a higher level, from the divine level, to become human, whereas the others, he's a human whose divinity, as it were, emerges through his life and teaching and death and resurrection. So I think actually we need both. And if we have in physics there's both too, because physics on the one hand deals with subatomic particles in quantum theory and tries to build up atoms and things, protons and things from quarks, and then atoms, molecules, and so on. So it's a sort of bottom up from tiny evanescent particles upwards. But on the other hand, cosmology starts from the Big Bang, and in superstring theory there's a kind of primal unified field with 10 dimensions. There's a primal field which is a unifying field, and is still present in its reduced form of the universal gravitational field, which is a field that holds the entire universe together and it encompasses everything within it. And then we've got levels of field organization in galaxies. Each of there's a kind of galactic field, not just a gravitational field, but an electromagnetic field, huge currents passing through galactic arms of millions of light years long, and vast magnetic fields, and the sun itself with all its magnetic and electromagnetic fields. And so we're within all these higher level fields. We're within the solar system and its field, and within the cosmic field. And panpsychism would say that there's consciousness at all these different levels. Now, some people would say, well, at the level of the whole universe, it's not a very high level of consciousness. It's just sort of keeping things in place, the gravitational field. And if the sun's got a mind, it's a pretty low level, you know, maybe lower than a plant or something. But actually, I myself think these may be vastly more encompassing and higher level minds. If we're within the mind of the cosmos and within the mind of the solar system, within the mind of Gaia, the planet, because they are all larger than us, and all of them, if they have some degree of consciousness or intelligence, would no doubt be able to influence what happens within their sphere of influence, namely on Earth and in human society and even in human minds. So there's plenty of potential sources, as well as traditional views about angels sending messages and giving inspiration, for top-down causation. Alfred Russel Wallace, who co-discovered the principle of natural selection with Charles Darwin, of course, as I think we've discussed before, believed that the entire evolutionary process was guided by intelligent beings which he identified as angels, you know, the intelligences that are guiding the evolutionary process. Now, obviously, they're not all guiding it in the same direction. It's not as if there's a single track of evolution that leads from bacteria straight to humans. There's a vast proliferation in the tree of life, and then there are junctions between the branches through symbiosis, and there's a huge number of species, I mean, a million species of beetle in the Amazon, the vast numbers of species that don't seem terribly relevant to the great human story that so interests us, but they're all there, they're all part of it. And and if one were designing a universe that would bring forth humans to who'd be able to think about it, it's hard to see quite why you need billions and billions of galaxies, each with billions of stars, and when you need all these species on Earth. So clearly the evolutionary process has sheer diversity, seems to be part of it. And I think when Teilhard de Chardin was thinking about this, I think he recognized that there was, on the one hand, a kind of proliferation of creativity for its own sake, a diversification, and also a kind of pull towards a unifying conscious principle, which he called the Omega Point. And it's not clear to me whether he thought of it as just something affecting humans or the Earth, or whether it affected the entire cosmos. But that's again a kind of top-down and teleological creative principle.
Yeah, I mean, maybe what lies behind some of that, well, the vision of the vastness of things, the diversification of things, is what do we think the cosmos is really for? What's its purpose? And in traditional modern science, that's a sort of nonsensical question. It's just processes unfolding without a deeper meaning behind it. But if the meaning is allowed and you start to think of it in terms of not just the bringing about of life, good things like that, and then the diversity, the beauty, the multiple manifestations might have meaning in the sense of just the proliferation of that goodness. And in brackets, not too quickly ignoring the fact that, of course, it brings about a huge amount of suffering as well. But if it's not just about the manifestation of goodness, but it's actually in the religious vein, the creation manifesting the creator, and moreover, then returning that love back to the creator, then perhaps this diversification, it's not just about we human beings, it's not just necessary for the production of us, but that we can be part of that. I don't know, you can reach for musical metaphors, the sort of symphony of creation, the extraordinary wonder that we feel when we look at the natural world is just our perception of that song of creation, back to the creator, and the creator's love pouring into creation. And so then our consciousness is one facet of that, I suppose. You've said before that the lizard basking in the sun might well be enduring a kind of ecstatic state of unity with the source of life that's its wellspring. Our ecstasy, our praise, if you like, is a self-conscious, deliberate, developed, participating manifestation of that too. So if you see, the purpose of creation as actually an expression of the divine life, in the early Christian church, figures like Gregory of Nyssa, I believe, would say that the creation has actually happened primarily within God, and that what we're experiencing is a temporal unfolding of that eternal presence. Then humanity's role, it's not like a sort of pivot point upon which the future of the cosmos depends, but it's one distinctive participation in that, that great symphony of life, that sort of conversation between the divine origin and the created world. But, we give expression to it in a particular way. You know, maybe there are creatures elsewhere that give expression to it in other ways as well. And when you're talking about the infinite divine, you would expect that, in fact. How could one finite mode, even in the diversity of human religion and so on, be enough? There would always be more. So, you know, I guess when I'm thinking back to Blake, that might be another way of in which humanity has a role in nature, when nature is seen not just as blind process or even deliberative process giving birth to things like life and consciousness, but as related to its origin, its source.
Well, that all makes sense to me. I think the only alternative seems to be one of kind of randomness, meaninglessness, chance, etc. If the universe is unconscious, if it has no purpose, if it's all just things just happening, because one thing happens after another in accordance with laws of nature which have no meaning or source or purpose, then it's a pretty gloomy picture and it doesn't give any kind of coherent story. So I think the only one that makes sense to me is more or less along the lines you just explained. I don't know though how, well, I mean, one further point perhaps worth mentioning is that we're in this process, because we've become so creative ourselves. I mean, humanity is now super creative and becoming more and more creative all the time. I mean, if you look at the Stone Age, you could have periods in the early Stone Age where technologies remained more or less the same for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. People were born and died in societies which more or less repeated what their ancestors had done for very long periods. And that's more or less what most species are like. They're creatures of habit, and they stay much the same for very long periods, as human cultures did. But we've now got onto this ever-accelerating path of development that really started in the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, or 5,000, 10,000 years with agriculture, or 20 or 30 or 40,000 years with art in caves and that sort of thing. I mean, it's relatively recent if you take into account 1 million years of human history and maybe more with different forms of humanity before that. So basically, rapid change is a very recent development, and most species don't do that. And so something's come into humanity that's led to this huge acceleration of creativity. And if part of the purpose of the universe is creativity and diversity, then we're obviously part of it. We've become part of this creative process at a kind of accelerating rate. So in that sense, we're co-creators with the evolutionary process. And I think where that's most obvious in biological terms is the areas that Darwin himself was so interested in, namely plant and animal breeding. Because in plant breeding, in horticulture, you know, if you look at all the different rose varieties we have, or all the different varieties of cabbage, I mean, starting with the humble sea kale, a kind of rather unimpressive ancestral plant, you get Savoy cabbages and Brussels sprouts and kale and Cavolo Nero and so on. And all these different forms of cabbage, all produced by breeding, and all the different kinds of dogs, all produced from wild wolves originally. I mean, these extraordinary range of forms that have come about through plant breeding. When you go around a garden, most of the plants you see have been bred by plant breeders. And when you buy fruit at a vegetable stall or a fruit stall, you know, those varieties have all been bred. And they're a kind of co-creation between humans and the animal and plant world. And of course, our technologies are co-creations as well, because we're using what raw materials we find in the earth, iron and titanium and silicon and that kind of thing. And we build all these amazing devices out of them. And now with artificial intelligence, we're so speeding up the entire process even more with computers. No, we don't know. I mean, it's sort of getting faster and faster. We, you know, it may hurtle completely out of control, or the whole system may break down. We don't know. We're incredibly vulnerable. We all depend on electric supplies, and transactions in most places are no longer old-fashioned cash, but electronic devices that can easily go wrong or be closed down by hackers. So we have no idea where it's leading, but it does seem we're part of a creative process that's become internalized in us, which is externalized in the whole universe, but internalized in us. Somehow that, if it's a divine creative principle, then it's sort of embedded now in humanity. And whether we like it or not, we're part of this accelerating process. We don't know quite where it's going, but it'd be impossible to deny that that it's happening.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel that perhaps we need a sort of expanded notion of this kind of progress or development as well, and not just technological process, progress, with all the advantages that no doubt brings, as well as the interest and fascination. When you were talking there about the different kinds of cabbage, it made me think about the naming of things. And again, this is a great feature, certainly, of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the importance of humanity in naming in the book of Genesis. And I wonder whether it links back to an older understanding of knowing, what it is to know something, because in the medieval world, in the ancient world, to know something was to participate in it. It wasn't just to stand back objectively and sort of give it a tag, as if the purpose of naming was primarily to categorize. Rather, the naming was itself to draw something out of that which was being named, so that both the namer and that which was being named had a kind of enriched life as a sort of product of that. You know, it's quite hard to make sense of that now, except that this verb to know is also used of union, in fact, and sexual union in particular. So in the Old Testament, the knowing of Adam and Eve was a way of talking about their sexual union. And of course, part of that is not just to breed, or Cain and Abel, but also is to enrich and fulfill their humanity, that in their union with each other, they might know of the ecstasy of their union with, other creatures, with God and so on. The erotic is just a sort of foretaste of that ontological joining. So hence knowing is about, you might say, I don't know, praising even. If you can name something, then you can differentiate it from other things. So that enriches the way in which you can talk about things. And again, talking, naming, praising, these are all functions in the Christian tradition of the logos, this extraordinarily rich ancient Greek word. And so, as well as the progressive notion of development that is so manifest, as you're saying, in our technology, I wonder whether we could, lessen or maybe diversify our urge to develop and to progress, which, might then help shift our relationship in terms of the exploitation that, of course, that brings about as well. Progress is very much part of the denuding of the environment as much as the diversification of the environment when you go to a garden or you go to a supermarket. But if we saw it in terms of enriching our capacity to sort of sing the praises of creation, and that is, good for us, and maybe even in some way good for the creation, that might bring another dimension into this. And I think this is probably closer to what Blake is talking about, because Blake, for example, will, in an ecstatic poem, list all sorts of things that he's seeing, both animate and inanimate objects, actually. He'll talk about the sea and the mountains and the meteors and the rain and the clouds. And then he'll say, and all these are men seen afar. This is his kind of recurrent phrase. And I think what he means by that, he means men in the generic humanity sense rather than just males. But what he's saying, I think, is that we have the capacity to know something of the quality of the existence, say, of a mountain or a cloud or the sea, and then we can put that into words in poetry or imagery, or even, in fact, in our spiritual lives. I mean, I you mentioned there the time that you were with B. Griffiths in his ashram in Tamil Nadu, and I went to Tamil Nadu myself earlier this year and went to Shantivanam, but also visited Tirumunamalai, which is the home of the ashram of Ramana Maharshi. And he very famously talked about the mountain there being one of his gurus. And I had very little sense what that might mean. It just seemed like a sort of romantic notion. But when you're there, my goodness, suddenly you get it, that the very presence of this mountain speaks to you of something that you feel within yourself as well, a kind of quality within yourself. You know, of grandeur, perhaps, of stillness, of eternity, however you might then try and find words to express this. But perhaps, you know, that can be part of our sense of development and progress as well.
Well, certainly through the arts, it's one of the major areas of human creativity, and not just painting and poetry, and but also music. I mean, these are all glories of humanity that, I mean, bird song is beautiful, but obviously we exceed the scope of that in a lot of the arts. I mean, something like the Bach Christmas Oratorio or something of that kind is so vast, complex, beautiful, amazing. That's obviously part of this creative process. But I think one of the things about the other species is that I think all of them are open to the divine in their own way. You know, when Aquinas was talking about the developments of plants and animals, he would say that they're actualizing their form, growing up and becoming their full mature form, is by actualizing their nature, they're coming as close to God as they can, because God is the ultimate being, and they share in God's being through actualizing all their potentials. So there's a sense in which all of creation is a reflection of the divine, and participation in the divine. For that matter, sexual activity is obviously not confined to humans, and obviously it's highly motivating for humans, but so it is for other species. If it wasn't, they'd die out. And one could argue, I would argue, that, you know, orgasmic experience is a kind of opening of a window into divine joy, however brief it may be. But there's this, so all of creation, in a sense, is reflecting the divine consciousness, which in traditional theories would be why there's so much beauty in the world. I mean, all these flowers and animals that are so beautiful, butterflies, flowers, I mean, they were beautiful long before there were any humans around. I mean, flowers evolved about 100 million years ago, you know, long before the founding of the Royal Horticultural Society. You know, beautiful butterflies and iridescent beetles were, you know, again, you know, huge amounts of time, 100 million years or more, has been all this beauty in the world. And it wasn't, I don't think, I mean, evolved hundreds of million years in advance just so humans could enjoy it. I think there must be something about animal minds, even plant minds, insofar as they have minds that can appreciate beauty and reflect the beauty that underlies the cosmos. So, you know, I think we bring to consciousness something but which is much more widespread. I don't think that all of nature is sort of darkly unconscious until humans or apes come on the scene. Otherwise, I think it's incomprehensible that there'd be so much beauty in the insect realm and indeed in the whole of nature.
Yeah, you reminded me again of Darwin, where he talks about the female, I think it's pheasants, who are looking at the male pheasants displaying. And it seems quite clear to Darwin that there's an aesthetic appreciation in the female pheasants, the peahens, as much as you know, just a sort of pure bigger and brighter is somehow better. There is sort of subtlety going on there. And you know, you mentioned the beauty of flowers. There's something excessive about all this. You know, a flower doesn't need to be like that merely to attract an insect. It's almost as if the insect and the flower are in some kind of collaboration of excess and beauty, and but living out in their own way, which, as you say, we beings who have this reflective conceptual consciousness kind of add another dimension to as well. Well, look, what we've been saying has given me a lot of food for thought, and I hope to those who have been listening in as well, and certainly, you know, making sense whilst recognizing the destruction and damage that humanity can cause, but maybe the beginnings of a returning to a vision of what we're about that can be built into all our activities with the natural world as well, of which we're a part, of course. So look, thanks very much. That's to say, thanks very much indeed, Rupert.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark.